It's Broadway, just meddling with the marbles in your mind. You're just trying to unwind, but then you find you're driving home third eye blind. The cops catch you.
I can see a lot more if I'm rhyming than I can if I'm just talking. My kids had a hard time with a sense of permanence or belonging. And we were right across the Hudson River from the Twin Towers.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Broadway Bill.
When I was a kid growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, rock and roll was first, it was just starting. My earliest recollections are like 1955, 57. Rock and roll radio was just getting going. There was a disc jockey, Alan Freed, who actually coined the term rock and roll. And I used to listen to him when I was a little kid.
This is WINS New York, 1010 on your dial, the home of the big beat in popular music in America. Yours truly, Alan Freed, the old king of the rock and rollers. Here's a new rock and roll.
And I also used to listen to this guy on WHK. His name was Mad Daddy. And he'd be on late at night, and I'd have him on in my bedroom when I was supposed to be already asleep, listening as quietly as I could so my parents wouldn't hear. And this guy sounded kind of like Dracula with rhyming. And he'd go, it's your Mad Daddy whooping and a bumping on the mellow jello side. And I'd hear him doing this stuff, and I go, wow, I'm kind of scared and titillated at the same time.
Whippy-dippy-doo-dow, Scooby-Doo. Before we play another etching, here's a word from the VOO at 300 Prospect Avenue. They got the pop and the bop and the rhythm and the blue and the monaural records and the stereo, too. They're all racked up in there waiting for you. 300 Prospect Avenue. I'm sure you're going
and,
to
and say. I think that's when I just started to really go, wow, if I could do this someday. And my mom was always very supportive, saying, oh, that would be a great career. You really should think about doing that. And as time went on, I kind of forgot it. When the Beatles came out, me and every other kid my age, 14 years old, all wanted to be in a rock band. And so I learned how to play guitar, and I was in a bunch of rock bands in Cleveland growing up. And I didn't even consider radio again until I was flunking out of my third major in college. All the bands started breaking up. And everybody wanted to do a different kind of music. Me and my buddies wanted to do a little more blues. And, you know, other guys wanted to do jazz. Some other guys wanted to do pop. And so here I am stuck in college. Don't want to be a dentist. Don't want to be a business administration major. Don't want to be a child psychologist, although the classes were fun because all the chicks and the nurses were in those. This one girlfriend I was with told me, why don't you do what you always wanted to do when you were a kid? And, you know, the light bulb went off. And I got into mass comm at college, and I also decided to go to a broadcast school at a radio station, and they used the radio station's live copy for reading commercials, which is, you know, the business of radio is what they taught very well, how to run a console, how to read with inflections, how to be able to read without stuttering or stammering or stumbling, all of that. So I got a lot of that, and, you know, how to record tapes and, you know, go after job offers. It was pretty comprehensive. I liked it. And I got the bug. Got my first job. Told them I'd work for free at a station in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, WLYT. It was an oldies station originally, and I was awful, pitiful. I stunk. And I was, you know, they put me on Sunday morning so I could run the religious programs and the tape programs and all the public affairs shows. And finally, I got a break. And that was somebody showed me this pair of headphones. They were called Koss Pro 4 AA headphones. And they were big and heavy, but it was like having a couple of JBL speakers strapped to your head. And it actually made my voice sound good enough for the radio. So I had enough confidence to be able to speak without fear. And that changed everything. I got one of the guys got fired, and I wound up doing afternoons at that station. And then things moved down from there. A consultant came into that radio station by the name of Bill Paris, who taught me just about everything I know about formatics and strategy and on-air technique that I've carried through to this day. In fact, I use it more now that I'm working at CBS FM than I have maybe in the 30 previous years. But he taught me a lot of that stuff. And he also had other radio stations he was consulting. And about 2 years after our relationship at that station, he took me down to Columbus, Georgia, made me the program director at WCGQ in Columbus, Georgia, where I really got my chops leading a bunch of jocks and, you know, understanding and putting into implementation all of the stuff he had been teaching me. And then he had some more stations down south. So on the weekends, I'd go to a radio station in Montgomery and go in there and audit them and give them pointers and actually maybe even hire and fire a couple of people. We had another station in Tallahassee, Florida. On another weekend, I'd go down there. Had another station in suburban Atlanta. I'd go in there and do that. And I did that for about 3 years, you know, in residence in Columbus, Georgia, and then around to the radio stations in the region for the weekends. It actually fit very well because I would turn it into a clubhouse. I didn't have a very straight-laced management style. My style was come on over to my house, let's get high and talk about what our next promotion is going to be. And so I'd have the staff over, or else because we were all so poor, nobody made any money. I would get the sales department to give us a trade out at a restaurant where we'd go and put up a ridiculous tab drinking beer and, you know, eating pizza and that kind of thing. And just have staff meetings and parties at restaurants or over our house and, you know, out of the radio station almost all the time. Oh, yeah. Because I was the program director, I was breaking music as it was coming out. The Aerosmith album, Toys in the Attic. I remember picking that up and going, this whole album is going on my radio station this afternoon. And it was a top 40 station, so, you know, that really wasn't allowed. So I found a way around that. You know, I put together a promotion where I traded out for about 60 brand new albums, the Aerosmith albums, and I made it a weekend promotion where I gave the album away. I'd have every one of the disc jockeys play a cut from the album and give it away. So I found a way. Well, you know, a lot of the things I'm proud of at that radio station is we took it to number one and beat all the other radio stations maybe in a 100-mile radius because we had a great signal. But after a while, the consultant's agreement with the owners ran out, so he decided to go to a station across the street. And because I really was loyal to him, I took me and my staff across the street, which was fine. Stayed there about a year or two, but then, you know, the sales department wasn't that good, so the paychecks started bouncing. And what can I tell you? I wound up leaving that situation, that programming consultant. I was so limited in scope to my thinking. I never really looked ahead. I never really considered it more of a career than where's my next stop going to be. You know, in radio in America in the 70s and 80s, and even before that, if you're a disc jockey, what you're really concerned with is getting ahead and moving up in market size and getting to the top. So it was something I expected to do. It was something that I was kind of prepared to do. And I kind of figured if I could stay every place at least 3 years, I'll get a good feel for the market. I'll learn my craft and I should improve to the next level within 3 years. I didn't think it was smart to go to a place and last only a year. So like I said, in 1977, when I went to Hartford, WTIC was a brand new top 40 startup station that had been a classical music station. And the programming consultant, Mike Joseph, hired me to be the program director and do the same thing. I did afternoon drive and programmed it. And I tried to run it as much the same way as I had programmed other stations in the past, but it was more straight-laced. It was owned by a very straight-laced corporation, and they wanted me in there at 8 a.m. in the morning, and I said, nah, I'm not that kind of guy. That's not the way I operate. So I decided to resign the position as program director and just be the disc jockey. And that lasted for 5 years, you know? So it was good. And then I wound up moving to KFRC in San Francisco, which is a legendary radio station in the United States. It was just a powerhouse on the West Coast from maybe 1967 to 1987. It was a good 20-year run at number one. It was a great radio station. It was totally chaotic, off the hook. Typical what you think of San Francisco used to be like. A lot of sex, drugs, rock and roll, a lot of really creative promotions, a great budget, limousines, parties, great radio.
Vacation included a trip down to Sunset Strip. I saw these babes walking down the street with their cheeks hanging out. I was just about to go for a pair of Betty Davis eyes when I realized I had to come back to work. But I ask you, is this work? KFRC.
Unbelievable engineering feats. We had a mobile studio, and we had our chief engineer in an airplane. And we would actually be able to drive the mobile studio. And I mean, it had a studio. I mean, it had all the machines. It had the console. It had everything totally self-contained with an antenna on the top. We would send the signal to our chief engineer flying above us in an airplane who would transmit the signal back to the transmitter. And so we could drive around the Bay Area on the radio. It was awesome. And things like that would happen. I mean, but the problem was, is we were so over the top, we all kind of burned out. Everybody kind of burned out after about 3 years. We had just too much of everything. And what can I tell you? It kind of started to fall apart. But what a great radio station. One of the greatest memories of any radio I've ever been associated with. Although maybe not quite as successful as some of the radio I'm into now, it was a real milestone and really legendary in the radio industry in the States. Oh, gosh, yes. Anything from Huey Lewis in the News. He was a local at the time. And when we started playing his music, he broke out nationally. Anything by Blondie. She was huge at the time. We played everything. But what we really found our success at that radio station at KFRC was all the funk we used to play from the East Bay. Oakland in the East Bay of San Francisco is Chocolate City. And we had a lot of great soul. Sly and the Family Stone originally came out of there. Everything evolved, and we had a large black audience, and we just catered to it. And we were all pretty funky on the radio to begin with. Ebonically speaking, I would really start rapping and rhyming a lot when I was at KFRC. And it played well not only with white audiences, but with, you know, actually Asians, African-Americans, Hispanics. And that's a real cross-cultured area of the country anyway to begin with. So it became more than a novelty. It became relatability.
You got down.
Well, like I say, when I was in Cleveland growing up, you know, old-timey disc jockeys in the 50s used to actually sound like that, you know? They'd be talking that jive and moving at five in the city of trees, if you please. You know, they'd be doing all of that stuff. And I thought that was pretty cool. But by the time I had gotten onto the radio, and the FM era had actually blossomed, and rock music had moved through its transition from bebop to more of head music, you had to be more real. You had to be more honest, not only in your delivery, but with your content and you know, your vocabulary. I wanted to rhyme because I knew it was attractive, and I knew it fit into the confines of a 15-second intro. I can say a lot more if I'm rhyming than I can if I'm just talking, or even just talking fast. And when I realized that if I was rhyming with content and not just articles or something trite like two and blue and how about you, you know, that kind of stuff. If I was using content and rhyming actual content, it actually came off sounding ridiculously intelligent. Rather, it almost sounded more poetic and frenetic than it did trite. And wow, was something else. So I really started, I mean, my program director at KFRC, Jerry Cagle, is the one who came up to me and said, you know, that stuff you do with the, do that every break from now on. And I said, okay, all right.
KFRC, hi, I'm Bill Lee, the night jock letting it rock who can't moan. I mean, for the next 3 minutes, I get to chaperone three tasty pointers through the airwaves of 610. Here, Bonnie, grab my arm here. This is the control room. And over there is the engineer. He's a little shy.
Gosh, I got fired from KFRC for doing something off color. And I wound up a friend of mine who had been working at KFRC, who was a program director for the RKO radio chain, which owned 10 of the biggest powerhouses around the country and in Canada. He and I decided to go up to Fargo, North Dakota, and start a five-station network that covered North Dakota and Minnesota. And it was just for yucks, you know, shits and giggles. And we had a great time up there. But it's Fargo, North Dakota. I'd go to work. I was doing mornings for him, and it'd be 40 degrees below zero. And I said, you know what? This has been fun, but I can't keep doing this up here, way up here in the Great White North. And so I took a job with some old friends who had actually Rick Cummings, who I worked with in Hartford at TIC back in the 70s, had actually become the vice president of MS Communications, and they had just bought a new property in Minneapolis, WLOL. So I went there with total control and autonomy over my show, and because I was a big name that they knew, the management and the owners and the programmers in that town knew, they let me just do whatever I want. And I just came in there like gangbusters into Minneapolis, and I got attention real quick. And it was the exact same time that Prince was coming out with Purple Rain. So it was like a whole scene happening. You had all these groups like Morris Day and the Time and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and Prince and the Revolution. And you had all these bands that were happening in Minneapolis. And then I show up, and it was a real memorable time. I mean, it worked out really well, and we were very, very successful. And I don't think anybody in Minnesota ever heard a disc jockey rhyme all the time. I think I was the first one they ever heard do that. If you're stylized and specialized, it's my belief now that you can play that act or whatever that is, your style, in almost any market now. It's getting homogenized. And the more I see people from the UK or even around the globe react to these breaks that I put on Facebook or Twitter or even Instagram, the more I realize is that even though it's not popular to do that kind of thing in other countries, the disc jockeys over there know that it would be if they were given free rein to do it. That's almost every comment I get from around the world from those breaks I do is that, wow, we could do this and it would win.
96 KPKE, Denver's better music station. On the run through 51 minutes and nonstop better music. This hour I'm going to do something about you from level 42.
I decided to leave there for personal reasons, went to Denver, Colorado, and had a blast. What happened was that radio station was owned by a group called Doubleday, who was in the process of probably restructuring the company. So I went down there, and we didn't have a general manager for the whole 2.5 years I was there. So the program director and I just ran the whole radio station any way we wanted to, without any corporate interference whatsoever. And ridiculous promotions, crazy on-air content, great ratings. So every rock band that came through there, we had them on the air immediately. So we had credibility, we had ratings, we had promotions, we had everything you'd want in a radio station, and we're quite successful. In fact, when I got the call to leave there and come to New York at Hot 97, they threw me a party, and I asked if I could have all the disc jockeys from the other radio stations in town on my show that night. And I would let them try to convince my audience that they should come and listen to their show now that I'm leaving town. And I got to tell you, it was just the best time I may have ever had in radio. I mean, it was a party, so there's a lot of smoking and drinking and carrying on in the studio. And a lot of that was videotaped. And everybody had a good time trying to, sway my listeners away. And because, you know, one of the things I've been very blessed and fortunate to be is I always have a lot of camaraderie with almost every radio professional in the market that I've ever been in, because I like radio and they like radio and we all get along, and I love the media in any town I've worked in.
96 KPK, he got a call from Greenwood Village. These babes know that no one can second pillage airwaves like I can. Here's one by Dean Martin called Part-Time Liver.
So anyway, I leave Denver in 1986 because I get the call from some more friends to come to New York and start up a new station, Hot 97. Pretty intimidating coming to New York. And it is for everybody in media. I think if you're in the media in the UK, you want to work in London. If you're in the media in the United States, you want to work in New York or Los Angeles. So yeah, it was a big deal. But I had been in radio about 18 years by that time, so I wasn't intimidated in the studio, I'll tell you that. And I just took creative license. The music we were playing was something called freestyle music, which is a combination of rhythmic top 40, maybe the biggest pop hit, and Hispanic dance music, which was starting to blossom at that time. It was this freestyle music was happening with all these local artists in the Bronx and Manhattan, uptown Manhattan. And we had our own stable of stars. We'd go out and do these caravan shows every weekend that would go like 4 or 5 hours with 20 acts. And we created our own scene. Long about 4 years into that job, though, I realized how important hip-hop was getting. And we wouldn't play hip-hop. In fact, nobody on the radio in the United States was playing hip-hop. It was all street parties up in the Bronx or in Brooklyn, and I used to get calls from these guys when they'd hear me rapping and rhyming on the radio. Chuck D from Public Enemy used to call me and say, man, you got to come up to our Get Down this weekend. We're doing this. You and me could freestyle on the mic, son, and then we could go up to your radio station, do it up there. And I really wanted to do that. Biz Markie wanted to do that. Freedom Williams from CNC Music Factory, a lot of the guys in the late 80s when hip-hop was just starting to blossom big time, you know, I got to know those guys.
And you know, you look outside, the day is gray, you're a little depressed, your mind is messed, but you know what just blows? Now the Cineplex is charging $7.50 to get into the shows on the weekends, man!
I wound up leaving Hot 97 because they refused to play any hip-hop, and I knew that's where the music was going. I just knew it was. And so this guy who used to be my phone operator as a teenager back in San Francisco at KFRC was now the program director of KMEL in San Francisco. So he hired me back to do mornings. And that was the first hip hop station in the United States. We had a big urban following. And yet at the same time, because guys like me were on that radio station, we were able to incorporate the suburbs. You know, all the white people listen too. And we really were successful. KMEL really became the model for hip-hop, rhythmic, urban music.
There are only two times when everyone is equal. Birth and death. What happens in between is up to you.
KMEL says end racism now.
It's funny because there was a convention my first year at KMEL in San Francisco in 1991. There was a convention in town and all the people from Hot 97 in New York came out and they heard the radio station. They saw what we were doing on the streets and they kind of took it back with them and convinced their owners that they need to do it. And that's finally when Hot 97 went hip hop in New York. And I was in San Francisco at that station till about 1995, and then I got fired due to budget cuts. And they never really topped my ratings, so I don't feel bad. but I was out of work for a whole year, and, you know, it was tough. I did some fill-in gigs around the country. I did some volunteer work with AIDS food banks and with teaching English as a second language to immigrants, which was my favorite job of all time outside of radio. And it was just so much fun. They're so cute, and they would turn phrases, twist them so wrong. It was hilarious. I should have taped it. family. It's been very fracturing to my family. You know what? In all honesty and all candor, no one really ever had a sense. My kids had a hard time with a sense of permanence or belonging. And my sons, my older sons, had a little more hard time with it than my daughters. By the time Beth and I had our daughters, we really stayed here in New York for 20 years. So they got that permanence. By the time I found permanence in radio, my boys were grown up already. They were well into their late teens and early adulthood. But it hurt them, and it hurt my first marriage quite a lot. My second marriage, because my wife is in radio, she's in radio right now. She's in Atlanta working in radio right now while I'm in New York. She comes up once a month or so. My daughters are both, one graduated from college, the other one's still in college. And I have to tell you one thing, though. The positive upside of it is every one of my kids has slept under the console at one time or another. They, you know, spend nights at the radio station. Daddy's got a new production. I'll be, you know, go to sleep, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, with my wife being in radio, they've been under her console asleep too. So there's a lot of good memories there too. And we've gotten to do a lot of great family things through promotions at radio stations that most normal families don't get to do. Most kids don't get to go backstage and meet their favorite Broadway actress who's playing the part of Belle in Beauty and the Beast, you know. It's stuff like that that has been high highs, low lows.
509, Mr. Lee, using that professionally trained tongue of mine. How about you using yours?
Let's go, Miss. Hold up your end.
Yeah, hold up your end, my friend. I'm about to send you flying. Say it again. Come on.
Came back to New York and worked at KTU very successfully for 10 years. I mean, that radio station, everything we did worked. Everything, every ratings period we had, we were at the top. It just didn't stop because we had, here again, a great cross-section of former radio stars playing dance music that hadn't played dance music since Hot 97 went hip-hop. So there was the perfect niche for that radio station. And I was there for 10 years. Winning, all the time winning. And it was very creative. They let me go crazy. I started doing a lot of phone calls at KTU, incorporating that into my show, to the point where I'd do rapping and rhyming. I'd do phone calls. I'd break records. I'd have interviews with great stars, everybody from like Cher to Stevie Wonder. That caliber of star would be on my show all the time. And in person, I hated phone call interviews. It was really great experience. I was there for 10 years and then was let go due to budget cuts. It was during the consolidation period of radio in the United States when the big companies were forming, Clear Channel, CBS. It was before Cumulus, but I mean, you know, they were buying all of the radio stations and they were cutting a lot of the budgets because they could overlap personalities and not really syndicate them, but voice track them. And that became the business model in the United States. So I was cut out, but I knew that I had a good enough reputation that I'd work again. And it took about a year, and I got the job at CBS FM, and I've been there the last 10 years.
We're hearing a couple of witnesses who said they saw a plane fly right into the building. Tom Kaminsky in Chopper 880 back with us again.
And we are getting a look at the south side of the building.
I was actually at home when I saw it happen on TV. So I hopped in my old Jeep Wrangler and I started driving into the radio station, which was kind of a feat because all the roads were getting closed. Nobody was getting in. And I was able to, you know, show my ID to a couple of policemen and they let me through. And I just came in and most of the time I was on, and we were right across the Hudson River from the Twin Towers. I mean, it was like in our window. It was like watching it on TV only live. Everything that was happening was right out our front window at KTU. And that in and of itself, I mean, you would see people on the sidewalks in front of the radio station on their knees sobbing. I mean, people coming over on boats looking like refugees, you know? It was just, some of the sights and sounds that day were incredible. But I spent most of my time on the radio that day because all the radio stations shut off and there were only like a couple of news stations that stayed on the air, and we stayed on the air, and I was just taking phone calls from people, and because a lot of people had to emotionally get it out, A lot of people were stuck and couldn't get home because the roads were closed. And a lot of people had kids that were stranded that couldn't get back to their parents and all that. I mean, it was a lot to talk through. So I stayed on the air for about 8 hours that day. But that also gave me the ability to speak, you know, in a serious, sincere, credible manner with people on the phones. Fortunately, the one aspect I have learned, and I learned it best at KTU, was when I incorporated the phone calls, I became real and conversational. So you know that, like a character on Saturday Night Live or sketch comedy, they knew that when I'm introing a record, I'm feeling it, I'm going with the music, but that's a character just as much as the lead singer of the song is a character in character. So I would still have the credibility to be that guy right up alongside the lead singer of the song. And at the same time, I could next break do a phone call where I'm just as conversational with them as I am with you. Only 9 times out of 10, I'd have a punchline before the vocal came.
KTU.
Oh, shoot, I didn't get it, did I?
Not even close.
Ah, boogers. I guess I'll try again.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Ah, crap. KTU.
Yeah, you gonna play the
Macarena
song?
Yeah, we'll get to it. KTU.
I'm going to win.
That's it. A good positive mental attitude.
That's it. I'm going to win.
Just keep telling yourself.
You got it.
All right, now click your heels 3 times.
Okay.
See you, Dorothy.
WKTU, New York.
Everybody. Yeah. Yes, it's the end of the show. Yeah. Mr. Lee, gotta go. Yeah. Till tomorrow, stay calm. Kiss your mom, bend a bomb, do the best you can. God loves you, man. Coming up next, according to...
Especially right about that time in 1996, nobody was doing that. And that's why I stuck out. It was one of the reasons I stuck out. And the nicest form of flattery is everybody else in the market, and especially first everybody else at my radio station, was learning how to do it by listening to me. And then everybody started doing it. And you know what? I think that's great. You know, if you can make good radio, great. I don't care.
New York's greatest hits, CBS FM.
Just about everybody I started out in this business with, unless they got into an aspect of the business that had nothing to do with on-air work, they all dropped out because they couldn't make the jump to digital. They couldn't make the jump from analog airplay to digital airplay. They couldn't take a turntable and be able to transfer to a mouse. And it took me a while, too. Believe me, there were times when I'd say, you mean the entire radio station is working off this little stinking mouse? You mean if I just go like that and click something, I'm going to change everything on the air right now? Which is wonderful when you're under time constraints, because there's no way I'd be able to do the show the way I do the show today without digital help. You know, digital editing, digital scheduling, digital transfer, you know, cut and paste, or just, you know, moving, dragging, clicking and dragging. There's no way I'd be able to get as much done if I wasn't able to do everything digitally.
CBS FM, Broadway, got my liquid lips revving, playing New York's greatest hits and on duty till 7. I love walks in the park. I love songs that make it to the top of the chart. I love you in high heels, pearls, and a mink stole, but most of all, I love rock and roll.
I really am a combination of all the people that I've worked for in my life. And it's one of my firm beliefs that I learned early on is any radio station necessarily will take on the personality of its chief person, like a program director. If the program director is low-keyed and very reserved, then the entire radio station is going to sound low-key and very reserved. If the program director is wild, drinking liquor, smoking cigarettes, and bringing women into the radio station, the whole staff's going to be like that, and it's going to sound like that. I have to admit, though, when it came to radio knowledge, strategy and programming, taking creative license, being able to manage people, learning how to listen, every program director I've had has taught me a piece of that, every one of them. Jerry Cagle at KFRC taught me to go ahead and just go for it and take creative license. my current program director, Jim Ryan, is teaching me how to really consider editing myself, but at the same time, going for all of it and don't constrain your subject matter or whatever you're doing. Just use your brain to who your audience is. Great program director. But I think all of them together make up who I am and what I allow to come out of the speakers on my show.
WCBS FM.
Just about every station I've been at has quite a history. CBS FM was the oldest station in New York for, gosh, decades, since the early 70s, since I've been in radio. And when they took it off the air, because when I was at KTU, my wife and I said, you know, when, you know, you get up there and your hair's turning gray and, you know, all of this, you may want to work at CBS FM. And I said, oh, hell yeah. I could play everything I've ever played in my career at CBS FM. It'd be great. I can't wait. I can just rhyme and rap all the time on that station. And in 2005, they took it off the air and replaced it with the Jack format, which was very eclectic. I kind of personally liked the music that they were playing, but they automated it. You know, it was all tracked breaks with no disc jockeys. And I was crushed. I was crushed because I had always planned to work there toward the end of my career. And fortunately, while I was out of work after KTU, I had a lot of interviews with the people that owned the station at CBS. And I'd get to a point in the interview where they'd say, well, what did you think of CBS FM going to Jack? And I'd say, the stupidest friggin' move you people ever made. And I'd come right out and tell them it was such a bonehead move because CBS FM had such already branded call letters. You don't ever throw away a brand. No, regardless, you can relaunch it and remake it, but don't ever throw the name of a big brand out. And that's exactly what they did, and they wanted to hear that from me because I think almost everyone in the company agreed with my point of view. And so I was the first guy they called when they relaunched it and brought it back on the air in 2007.
Yeah. This is CBS FM 101.1, and that's the first time I've said that here in a couple of years. But I think there's a script here for this other guy here. You recognize
him? Oh, yeah, this guy here. I know him by sight, but not by by call letter.
Broadway Bill Lee, thank you for welcoming me. Oh, yeah. Call letters would be CBS FM 101.1. Did I get that right?
You got it right,
baby.
I want to just put this out to every cocky disc jockey who's out there out of work right now. The gates of heaven are now open.
Yeah.
All right? Because I died and went to heaven on CBS FM.
First and foremost, I could not work as hard as I do at my age. I'm 66. I could not do it this well if I wasn't sober, okay? And believe me, a lot of disc jockeys in the United States, there was no such thing as sober. When I was coming up, if you weren't using, you weren't in. You just couldn't get in the circles. And, you know, once I got sober, I started to obviously recover mentally, spiritually, and physically to the point where now I work out every day. I'm smart enough to take a nap every day. And I have maybe about an hour and a half of show prep time. It's almost all online. Everything I do is online. I just online take notes, write punchlines, that kind of thing. And when I get in there, first and foremost, I have the energy, I have the circuitry, and I have the ability to be able to pour it all out and leave it on the field for 4 hours. Of course, I'm, you know, drenched and used up by the time I walk out of the studio, but I'm able to do it at my age, you know, so I'm really loving it. And honestly, we're so consistently successful that I've never had a better time for as extended a period of time in radio.
We all know that from great food to historic architecture to terrific theater, New York, New York has the best of everything. And now, after a brief interlude, that once again includes oldie stations. On behalf of the city of New York, I extend a hearty welcome back to all those associated with WCBS FM. May you remain on the air until Fergie's version of Big Girls Don't Cry.
I stand up on the radio because I did enough sitting down today. If I'm sitting there, first and foremost, I'm going to get lazy. Secondly, I won't have the breath control I need to pull off some of the stuff I do on the radio. And thirdly, I'm moving around the studio a lot. And if I'm not moving around the studio, I crank up the monitors and dance. I mean, I want to enjoy the music. If I'm playing it and I'm not enjoying it, they may or may not know that out there on the other side of the speaker, but my guess is you can feel it when I'm enjoying it. You can tell.
It's Broadway Bill Lee, perhaps New York's most dangerous job. Maybe going off half-cock, but on a day like this, I just want to rock! Yeah! Try not to be too overzealous, certainly not too jealous, but I think that's the tale those black crows are trying to tell us.
Oh, I don't really write out the rhymes, but I will write out, I'll type in the punchlines to some funny bit that I have or some, you know, content. So I'll take a look at the content that I have to fit into the song and realize how I'm going to end it. And sometimes that's the way the rhyme will go, or sometimes the rhyme will start at the beginning. But I always work it in. That's how I figured it out anyway, in about 2 minutes before I go on the radio, you know, while the mic is closed. The whole idea of having something to rhyme is having content. And I won't write out the rhymes, but I'll write out the content so that when I look at it, if I'm going to finish up my break saying the artist, which is Phil Collins, I'm going to have to come back to this piece of content and find something at the end of what I'm saying that rhymes with Collins. Like, pitching faster than John Rollins, singing better than Phil Collins, you know, bang, like that. No one can quite get it through their head because the world is not being run by artists. The world is being run by suits right now. So they don't get it. They don't get the fact that anything that's artistically creative is what really drives any product, whether it's a product on the radio or a product that you buy or an idea on how to market something like, you know, the mail order houses like Amazon or even Alibaba. Who would have thought that that would be successful even 15 years ago, because the dot-com market burst when they couldn't keep up with shipping demands. So no one really took it seriously. But now when you realize just almost all the stores in the United States are closing because Amazon is so doggone convenient, we have to look at radio that way too and say, wow, if they don't need a presenter to introduce the song because they're looking at the title and the artist on the scroll across the bottom of the screen that they're listening to, if that's our only function, and if you listen to most radio, I know in the UK and certainly in the United States, that's the way radio already is. You don't want to hear some guy talking over your favorite song. And as long as the scroll at the bottom on the RDS shows you what the artist and the title is, or you can put your Shazam up to the speaker and find out what it is, who needs them? Honestly, I think there's more to it. If the suits understood that people would rather hear music with a companion so that you can experience it with someone else. And unfortunately, when it comes to radio or even music listening in general, we do most of that in the car. So if there's nobody else to share the song with, at least I'm there to share it with. And if you weren't even thinking about it, I'll share it with you and say, hey, listen to this. You know, so it suits don't understand that because they don't think that way. They think dollars and cents, bottom lines, and what appears to be clever on the surface.
FM. It's Broadway putting New York's greatest hits under the spotlight. You know something? It's all in vivid black or white. And you might not want to change the station, because if you're patient, I'll have Def Leppard and Poison tickets coming in minutes. For the meantime, I'm ready to recycle one of the best ever from Michael.
I don't know. My contract's up in July of 2018. And we got new owners coming in. They sold the entire CBS radio chain to a company called Entercom. And if they like me, I'll keep going. You know, as long as I have the steam to go through, sure, I'll keep going. You never know, though. And honestly, the best part about being my age right now is it doesn't matter. I'll be happy either way, because I'll still do a weekend shift somewhere, even if it's in Podunk, Florida. You know, I won't care. I'll just be happy doing my little Saturday afternoon record party, you know. But the one reason I started doing video breaks and sending them out on all the socials is because I knew I can see the end of the tunnel. I just want to make sure that guys coming up know that there is another way to do it, and this is the way we all used to do it back in the 70s and 80s. We all used to do radio this way. Not just me. I'm just the only guy who's been able to last. You know, probably won't be able to be on the radio at some point, you know. There won't be any radio. I'm sure there'll be other platforms, but honestly, I've worked at Sirius XM, and it's tough when you have to voice track. I do voice track. I can voice track. It's not the same as cranking up the monitors, feeling the music, and going with it live, though. So, I don't know. Like I say, I'll keep going if they want me to, but if they don't, that's going to be okay. Every break that I put out, I'm proud of. And I won't put out anything I'm not proud of on video. The breaks really sum it up for me. And if you'll notice, I started out, I used to do video breaks every day, and then I learned something. I learned that, number one, it's too hard to top yourself every day. And number two, there's a burnout factor. It's kind of like if Elton John put out, in the 1970s, I think he put out like 4 albums in 1 year. And it was okay already, enough. If I hear another Elton John song on the radio, I'm going to throw up. And I found that people seem to react or learn or question by, in way of comments on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to most of the breaks that were quick, rapping, rhyming. But that's not everything I do on the radio. What I also, you know, I also do phone calls. I also do a lot of content that you can't rhyme or rap. It's just informational. I've done many breaks like that. They don't seem to get that sort and that much of a response, but I still want to put it out there because it's part of the real package of everything I do on the radio. There's a lot that goes into who that guy is that does those breaks, but I can tell you one thing. I can't be a negative person and look and act and sound like that. I can't be somebody without compassion or being able to relate to people and be that way if I wasn't in real life. So, and you know something? You don't even have to know anything about me specifically to know that when you see any of those videos or hear any of those breaks that I do on the radio, it's got to have a solid foundation spiritually, physically, and mentally, and compassionately to be able to do that. So I guess, yeah, that's the way I'd like to be remembered.